Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
This is the Writer's Lounge, and this is where we showcase new authors, and I am your host, Tom Riddell. This is show number 96, and the date is August 23rd, 2021. And let's see here. More about us. Here's where you can find us out there on Facebook. You can find us at Facebook by searching the Writer's Lounge on Facebook, and find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriddell.net in the blog section. That's thomasriddell.net. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for the Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at TomRiddell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on our show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line, and we'll get back to you. Special note, we can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to TuneIn and ask her to play the Writer's Lounge showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. And excuse me for a second here. It seems as if I've got an audio problem, and I'm going to try to fix this, and hopefully I can. Hopefully that's working better than it was. Anyway, of a special note today, this show marks 10 years of the Writer's Lounge, and I want to thank all of our authors and listeners for helping to make this radio show a huge success. It's truly a pleasure for me to host this Blog Talk radio show, and I am just as excited now to sit here as I was 10 years ago when it all got started. I also owe a great debt of gratitude to my co-hosts down through the years, and they would be my wife, the late Lou Riddell, Lisa Lee, Robin Eduardo, and Bobby Hughes-Millman. You all added more depth, insight, and humor to our broadcast, and I think the over 60,000 listeners would agree. I'm now doing the show solo for the time being, but who knows what the future will bring. Again, thank you all. I expect this show that we dedicate to new authors to continue for many more years, because it is our motto to encourage writers and readers to keep that pen and their eyes to the page and to let the story begin. So that wraps up the show intro, and okay, so not sure what's happening with the audio here. Hopefully we can get it corrected. I'm checking with someone here to see if they can still hear me. Can you hear me? Okay, well, let's move on, and hopefully this works. If not, we're going to have to try something later on and see if we can fix this at another time, possibly. But the next topic would be writers' topics, and normally during this segment, we talk specifically to writers and authors about the tools we use to put a good and enjoyable story on a page and ultimately in a book. But today, we're going to change it up a bit, since the topic of our guest author's book has to do with slavery and the Underground Railroad. I thought it would be a good idea to add to the actual history of what we'll be discussing with author Deidre Sinnott and her book, The Third Mrs. Galway. I did some research on the topic of the Underground Railroad and came up with a clip I found on YouTube. It's from the channel Secondhand Topics, and it's titled How the Underground Railroad Worked. It's sort of a prelude to our discussion today. It's almost about 7 minutes in length, and after this discussion, after the conclusion of this clip, we'll be back to talk with Deidre Sinnott about her book, The Third Mrs. Galway.
To properly understand how the Underground Railroad worked, we first have to know what caused it, and that is slavery. Slavery's history spans many cultures, nationalities, and religions from ancient times and, unfortunately, still today. From all the enslavement periods throughout history, perhaps one is the most noticeable, the 246 years of slavery in the USA. The starting point of slavery in America was in 1619, when 20 enslaved Americans were brought to the British colony of Virginia. Over the following decades, hundreds of thousands of people were sold or kidnapped from Africa and shipped to 13 colonies, then forced into slavery. After the American Revolutionary War, some northern states abolished slavery, while the southern states had an economy built on it because the South had a perfect climate and available land to grow crops like rice, sugarcane, tobacco, and cotton. Until 1850, the balance was kept between the free states and the slave states. But after half of the 19th century, the situation tilted the balance in the favor of the Union because these five states joined the U.S. But for the purpose of this video, we are going to look at what an enslaved African American's life was like in the year of 1850, when the balance was still maintained. Back then, he didn't have many choices in life. He could remain on his owner's plantation, work 6 days a week from sunrise to sunset, regarding himself to a life of harsh and painful labor, barbaric physical punishment, and possibly a broken family as he watched his loved ones be sold away. Not all enslaved people had the same life, but this is what he might expect if he remained in bondage. Or he could try and run away, but escaping was anything but easy. So, due to hard labor and punishments, an enslaved individual decides to leave. The closer he is to the border between the free states and the slave states, the easier it is. This is why from the estimated 100,000 people who escaped through the Underground Railroad, many of them were from the border states, because the journey was much shorter and safer, and it was thought, once they arrived north, they were free. On the other hand, African Americans from the South had way longer journeys until the North, and probably many of them didn't even know the free states existed. As an enslaved individual, knowing how to read or write was a crime. So without any maps, not knowing where to head, escaping alone was very difficult. That being said, this is where the Underground Railroad comes into the story. As the name says, this route was made of many underground ghost train stations that led to the far north, even Canada, or at least that's what the myth says. In reality, it was neither underground nor a railroad, but a secret network which was not run by a single organization or person. It was run by both black and white people, who tried rescuing individuals to the far north. This system had a well-defined structure, and certain people had certain roles, whose names were coded, so masters and owners of enslaved people wouldn't be aware of the secret route. It is believed that the Underground Railroad was created shortly before the beginning of the 19th century by abolitionists, many of whom lived in Pennsylvania. Many abolitionists, or people who were enslaved but escaped on their own, joined the network. One of the most important roles in the system was the agent, who was a person that went to plantations to try and help the enslaved ones escape by telling them to meet at a certain time near the plantation with a conductor, who was a guide. Here, the first issue comes into the equation. What if no agent came? In this case, they had to escape on their own. But remember, they didn't have any maps, and most of them were illiterate. So without some outside help, this was very unlikely. But at least they had songs, as they were transmitted from generation to generation and contained hints that helped the escapees go north. So they were something like musical maps. Lyrics from Follow the Drinking Gourd are a guide for people who wanted to escape, and even the title means Follow the North Star. So, if the enslaved is alone, that's kind of the only thing that helps him. He had to leave at night and travel until the sunrise, rest in the day, and then again, when night came, follow the North Star and moths on trees to go north and hope for the best. Although going alone was not the best option, if one wanted to escape from bondage, he had to go on his own or wait for an agent to come. But he wouldn't know if somebody would ever try and rescue him. And if somebody came, how could the enslaved individual know if the supposed agent was trustworthy? Alright, now let's imagine that a true agent came. Now what's next? Generally, agents usually pretended to be enslaved to enter plantations and tell the others the date when they would have to escape. The perfect time would have been on a clear night on Saturday, because masters would have to wait until Monday morning to place an announcement in the newspaper that one escaped. The best season to try and escape was late fall or early winter, because the longer the nights, the more ground the escapees could cover. Groups couldn't be too big because they could be easily spotted. After the meeting point and time were set, they had to wait, act normally, and when the night came, leave. At the meeting point, they would find the conductor, where they will change the clothes because back then a group of African-American people with dirty clothes would look very suspicious. Then the guide would lead them through the night until the first station, which was 10 to 20 miles away. In case you didn't realize yet, each of the roles involved in the system had coded names that would have normally been used in a railroad system. The cargo, or the escapees, will wait at a station, which is owned by a station master, who is the owner of the safe house until the next conductor will come to move the cargo further north. To reduce the risk of infiltration, many people associated with the Underground Railroad knew only their part of the operation and not of the whole scheme. This process was repeated many times until the escapees finally arrived in the Free States, where they could enjoy freedom and never be enslaved again. Wait, what's that? It's the year 1850, and the Second Fugitive Slave Act passed? This basically encouraged capturing escapees and sending them back to the South. The penalties were harsher for people who hid fugitives, but it also created controversy. A free African-American black man in the North could be considered an escapee. Therefore, he could get enslaved and be sent to the South. A Fugitive Slave Act was previously passed in 1793, but this second one made many escapees go even further north, to Canada, or how it was called by enslaved individuals in the South, Heaven, or the Promised Land. There, they could avoid U.S. jurisdiction, and slavery wasn't a thing there, although racism still existed. Black people who were once enslaved formed communities, and men had the right to vote and the right to own property. All black people could earn a living, get married, and start a family. With assistance from Canada's government and abolitionist societies in Canada and the United States, building a new life was possible. But for some, this wasn't enough. They wanted to help. Some became conductors and went back to the South to try and free their friends and relatives. One of the most courageous and famous people during these times was Harriet Tubman. Between 1850 and 1860, Tubman made 19 trips from the North to the South, following the Underground Railroad, and set free hundreds of enslaved people. Slavery was one of the primary causes of the American Civil War, and both the victory of the Union and the passage of the 13th Amendment in 1865 ended slavery in the United States forever. And with it, the Underground Railroad became history.
And there you go. I hope you enjoyed that little clip. It was a good prelude to, I think, the book today, The Third Mrs. Galloway, and our guest author, Deidre Sinnott. And she'll be on shortly, but I want to introduce the book to her. But before I do that, I want to remind everybody out there that's listening live that you can call in and talk to Deidre or myself at area code 914-219-0868. That's again, area code 914-219-0868. And the book, The Third Mrs. Galloway by Deidre Sinnott. In my review, I wrote, in 1835, within the city of Utica, New York, as well as in cities and towns all across America, there existed people who harbored beliefs that were in stark contrast with their neighbors. Those differences were so raw with emotions and deep-rooted, embedded principles of God, family, and country, that they would shed blood to uphold their truths. Some brought voice to their passions. Some said Negroes were better off as slaves. Others said, if a man sees a great wrong, it is his duty to oppose it. These are the foundations of the story as a small boy and his mother escaped the torturous and deadly clutches of slavery and head north into New York State, where slavery was abolished in July of 1827. But there are still legal slave catchers around who want to return stolen property back to their owners in the South. The mother and her child are caught in a sudden thunderstorm and take cover in a shed on the property of a wealthy Utica man, and then the story heats up and brings others into a dramatic drama of morality where lives will be changed forever. I had a hard time saying goodbye to these wonderful people of the 1800s, and as I reached the last page, I would sincerely and respectfully ask Deidre Sinnott to not let them disappear and to bring them back into our lives. They have much more to say to us, and we as a nation have a lot more to learn. I predict that this book will soar up the bestseller list. This author has a lot to look forward to. This is a must read. And now it is my pleasure to welcome Deidre Sinnott to the Writer's Lounge broadcast, and with a little click of the magic button, as we say, we'll bring her on the air.
Hi, Deidre, Tom. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that wonderful review and the introduction. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for being here. And I'd like to ask you, can you please tell us a little bit more about yourself and what and who inspired you to write this wonderful, emotionally moving story?
Well, I grew up in Utica, New York, and never knew that there was any Underground Railroad activity or abolition struggle there. I eventually went to Syracuse University, which is not so far from Utica, and then went to New York City to become famous in the theater, which of course did not happen. So for a long time, my dream was to be a writer. And I'm glad in your introduction in talking about this show that you're hoping to encourage people to keep going. Because even though there were a lot of periods of my life when I was not writing, it was always a goal that I wanted to go for. And I had to sort out a lot of messy aspects of my life before I could truly concentrate on it again as a person over almost 40 years old at that time. The people who don't get published are the ones who stop writing, and the people who do find outlets for their work are the ones who keep going. And that, I think, is one of the most important messages for people.
Yeah, I would say that an author, you're sort of a late bloomer, as I am and several other people are out there. So, as you say, don't give up your dream. I'm 65 and just completed a book. So it's good to hear that you've taken up the pen later in life and followed your dream.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I talk about myself as a re-bloomer rather than a late bloomer because I kept blooming in different areas. But this and the understanding the history of Utica in particular, but upstate New York, has become one of my passions. And I fell in love with researching, which sounds kind of dull, but it's really exciting. And I fell in love with writing, and I fell in love with this story, which is based on a number of true events in Utica. So it really has become a passion project for me. And, I think it's all related. All of this history is not just old and doesn't matter anymore. it's related to where we are today. And I think that also is quite important in terms of my own development over time.
Right. And in the clip we played about how the Underground Railroad worked, I was struck by how much Canada played in the minds of these people who fled north to escape slavery. And even though there were reported to be 100,000 people in the Underground Railroad, so many more didn't even know that free states existed. Is this your understanding of what may have been on the minds of people back then?
Well, for example, there was it's an incident in Utica in 1836, which is like a year after when the novel is set, where there was two guys who were living in Shenandoah County, Virginia, and they had never heard of the word abolitionist, and they sort of maybe knew what an abolitionist was, but they thought that it must be some other kind of human being if they're helping African-American people escape from enslavement. And the first person they met was somebody in Philadelphia. So they went all the way from the Shenandoah Valley and made it all the way to Philadelphia before they ran into their first abolitionist. So while they, you know, knew that they were going to freedom because in their case, the woman who was claimed to own them, gave them money and said, go. They did not have, you know, a lot of information to go on. And they had to do a lot themselves and figure out what they were doing, where they were going and why.
And I guess the clues that were out there too, the clip that I played mentioned music was part of it, where they would give clues in titles of songs to help people go forth, to go north.
Well, I mean, one of the issues in the book is about the Colonization Society, which I had never heard of until, I guess, a decade or two ago. It was already in 1835, the U.S. had a colony on the west coast of Africa. Liberia, the country still exists, and the idea was to take all of the free African Americans and send them there. And one reason to do that for the slaveholders was they considered the free African Americans to be a problem, that they might be able to read, they might be able to tell enslaved people, oh, go here, go there, and if they could get them all to emigrate to Liberia, then that would remove one of their problems, and they could stretch out the life of slavery even longer than they did.
And kind of probably a little bit of a sweep underneath the carpet kind of thing, where they ignore the real problem and sort of focus on getting rid of them to another country. I imagine that was probably a lot in their minds back then, but I think some of the people back then were probably a little bit more forceful in being against slaves. And then you had another group that was probably a little bit more passive in regards to that.
You know, I think probably the vast majority of people didn't think about it too much. The slice of people who are active abolitionists or working on the Underground Railroad is rather small as compared to the whole population. And I think we find that to be true today. You know, if there's a certain sector of people who might call themselves modern abolitionists who are for the abolition of prisons, and the vast majority of people, if they don't have a family member or a close friend in prison, don't think about it too much. And I think that's sort of the way it was with enslavement. So, you know, it's like after the fall, after World War II, you know, everybody wanted to be in the French resistance, but it's simply not so.
Right.
You know, there's a whole lot of people who didn't know what they could do and were unable to do anything about the oppression that they might be suffering.
Mm-hmm. Maggie, one of your main characters in The Third Mrs. Galloway, I learned, has a connection to a person you knew as a friend. Can you tell us about Maggie and this friend you knew?
Oh, you know, the character of Maggie, I knew that I wanted to have somebody who was formerly enslaved in Utica, because even knowing that there was slavery in New York State, that was kind of new information for me at one point. I mean, I just was never taught that. It was always seemed to be something so far away in the South. So I wanted to make sure to have somebody who represented the enslaved people in New York State. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to have Maggie. And she turned out to be a character who just leapt off the page in a way that I was surprised at. And I had, first of all, Kaylee Jones, who is the publisher, said, oh, this happens all the time with novels. You know, sometimes there's a character you don't know is going to be important, but, you know, they just take their due. So I had written a draft, and I was showing it to a number of friends of mine, one of them, Priscilla, who read it, and she said to me, did you model Maggie after me? And I was a little bit in denial. So I said, no, you know, of course not. And then later I thought about it. Next time I talked to her, I was like, yes, I did. I absolutely did. I can't deny it. And she was so very proud and happy about that. She just died like last month of cancer.
Yeah, I
saw
that.
So one of the last images I have is her holding up the book from her hospital bed. And
wow.
She's just a wonderful dear, and she just was a take-no-crap kind of person.
And that kind of fits the character of Maggie from what I read. That's the way I perceived her, too. And it's interesting that you say formally enslaved, which means basically not really under slavery, but she's acting as a, I guess the more polite word would be like a housemaid in this household, correct?
Yeah, I mean, she's the cook. She, however, has everything that there is to do, you know, as Mr. Galway, who I think suffers from some kind of depression and addiction problems. You know, his life has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, and that means he's not got servants around, and he's just kind of isolated. And Maggie's his connection. You know, she's the one who takes care of him and does everything there is to do in the house.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about the title of the book. How did you come about with that title instead of something more, I wouldn't say more appropriate, but you came down on the side of this title. How did you come about that title?
This is an interesting question for me and other writers, I think. How do you end up with the right title? And for me, it was a process, and part of it was as the book developed that informed what the title was going to be. So when I started writing, I wanted to write something about the whole society in Utica. And so I was calling it, and I knew that this wasn't going to be the title, I was calling it The Society. Because I didn't want to just, I wanted to show my characters, but I wanted them to be operating within the social system that was in place. And then I was reading an almanac, and noticed that Halley's Comet was going through at the exact time that the novel was placed. And so I ran down and said to my husband, I said, Halley's Comet's going through right then. And he said, oh, perfect. You can call the book The Comet because, you know, in that time, comets were feared. They brought change. They thought that things were going to happen with these fiery comets. And certainly having people who are hiding in your shed, who are escaping enslavement, that changes your life very, very distinctly. So for a long time, I was calling it The Comet, and people did not love that title. And so I went methodically trying to come up with titles. And the third Mrs. Galway just jumped out of that list as a because it asked the question.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how when you're writing historical fiction, where, like you say, you're researching and you find out that these other events are happening around the story that you can't really possibly leave out because they're part of the land at that point in time. So that's real. What I really like about historical fiction is that you could connect it to other events that are happening around the characters, and then you can mold the characters to that event, which you did expertly. And I loved reading about that because I'm also a lover of the cosmos. And that really perked me up when you wrote about the comet. I thought that was really neat. I'm sure you did extensive research, as you had been saying, while writing the third Mrs. Galway. What was that like, and how did you describe, how did you decide to fictionalize some of it and also keep to the actual history, which I was just talking about, since some of your characters really did exist during 1835?
You know, I find that when I'm reading nonfiction, or even like right now I'm reading a somebody's journal from 1820 to 1860, and I'm just sitting there transcribing this journal, and I'm visualizing the whole thing that this person's talking about. So I think that for myself, the way that my brain operates is that in order for me to understand it, I have to see it. I have to recreate it and see it in my head. So I had, you know, I was looking around to try to find out, was there an Underground Railroad thing going on in Utica? And one of the first things I found was a reference to the Utica riot. And, you know, that had a kind of attractive sound to it. I mean, Utica riot, that's really exciting. So when I started researching it, I was surprised at that there was so much resistance to abolition. So there's the anti-slave society, and then there's the anti-abolitionists. And, you know, having a riot is kind of exciting. And as an activist, I haven't been involved in any riots, but I've certainly been involved in things that, you know, very exciting on the street. So I have a feel for that. And I wanted to bring this information to other people in Utica in particular, but as wide as I could. And I was trying to find a way to use the real dialogue, because there's a lot of these people quoted in contemporary newspapers, and I wanted to bring that out. So I was thinking about opera. Let's have an opera about it. But that's really daunting. It's so much easier to just sit down alone and write a novel. And so when I decided to start it, I was so pleased to have the voice of the narrator just come very easily, based on the language of the period that I've been reading about and other novels of that period. It just for some reason worked, and that was such a green light to keep going.
Right. And what you mentioned being an activist, one of the most uncomfortable feelings I came away with after reading your book was fear, because we're dealing with much of the same mindset in 2021 that was prevalent back in 1835. Do you think we've learned anything in 186 years, or do you think we're still on a very dark path as far as how we treat other human beings?
I don't think there's one answer to that. I think that there has been a lot of advancement and hard won, and also hard fought for. And, you know, I think also in 1835, if you really look at it, that one of the parallels to today is the story that we tell about what the situation is. And for people who were trying to extend enslavement into the territories, people were trying to keep it going for as long as possible. they had a wholly different story about what slavery was and why it was and who the enslaved people were than those who were opposing it. And so we had two different truths. And here we are now with at least two, maybe dozens of different truths. And trying to sort out what's the correct thing is a big challenge, but it's part of the challenge that we each have to get ourselves up to. You quoted Beriah Greene about when you see a great wrong, you have to work to right it. He was a fiery abolitionist who came to Utica in 1833 from the Western Reserve College. And out of context, anybody can say, I see a great wrong, and be absolutely not correct about what the great wrong is.
Right.
So it's hard to see clearly. You have to, you know, really work at it.
When somebody sees a great wrong, somebody else doesn't see wrong at all. They see it as a right, as they probably did, and they did back then, was to own property, and their property was a slave. So they honestly felt that, you know, that's my property. But I find it hard to get my head around the fact that you could look at another human being and see them as property and not as another human being.
Yeah, I think the trick is always to dehumanize people and to really not see them as fully human. And I think that that happens today and that in different situations. But even people who want to think that they're nice, I've just been reading this guy's journal, and he really, really wants to think of himself as nice and a good slave owner. But the language that he uses, the things that he does, not so good.
Right.
And so it just is. It can be more cut and dried. It really can. That there should be this dividing line, and humanity has got to be the important thing,
right?
You know, and seeing other people's humanity.
Absolutely. Who is your favorite character in The Third Mrs. Galway?
Oh, I suppose if I say Dr. McCook, people will not like me. Dr. McCook is this drunken doctor who's just careening all over the place and, you know, plays a role that's not very positive. He was fun. He was a fun character to write. And he got more fun as after the drafts, you know, like as the drafts went on. It was through like 7 or 8 full drafts till when Dr. McCook really started shining. I mean, I love Helen because she is a little ignorant, a little bit of, you know, sort of self-absorbed and not caring, but without the confidence of somebody who's mean. But she's got a lot of learning to do, and she ultimately accepts that she's got learning to do. And I think that I see a lot of myself in that, and obviously all of the characters, you know, are some extension of me, but also just that transition of kind of learning what life is. When I went to college, I thought I was going to be like a director of movies or theater, but I had no idea at 18 what life was about. I had no idea. I mean, I really, you know, was very innocent.
Yeah.
It took a long time to figure some things out.
Yeah, and you sort of alluded to it, but you don't use an outline when you write, correct?
I knew certain events that I wanted to have happen. Certainly I knew that I was going to include the founding meeting of the New York Anti-Slavery Society that caused this anti-abolition riot. So I knew that was going to be in there, and I knew I was, you know, that my character arc for Helen was one of learning And I wasn't sure of the ending. I definitely did not know how it was going to end when I started. And I did, and there was some stuff in the middle that I had that surprised me. That was based on research.
So the characters helped you along in that regard, I imagine, right?
The characters helped, and continuing to research helped. And when I found the thing that was happening at the time there that I had never considered, and it had just so outraged me, I knew that that was going to be the moral center of the book. And finding that moral center, which is what is important to find in any story, I think, then you can go forward. It's like, oh, this is it, you know.
Right. While writing the story, who did you share it with, and how did it make you feel to get the story out there?
I was working in a writer's workshop for long term. So this book is, in a way, a project of this writer's workshop. I mean, I wrote the book, but I was getting feedback from fellow writers the whole time. And I completed the first full draft. I started in 2015. I think by a couple of months into 2016, I had a full draft for people to read. And it was shaped a lot by Kaylee Jones, who is a wonderful writer on her own, and mm-hmm. a wonderful and generous teacher. And she really helped steward the book through and keep me going and keep me moving in the right direction. And she's just excellent in terms of structure. Which I did not know exactly how to do.
I also understand that your husband was a big fan of your book.
Yes, he's been there the whole time. He's a writer of different kinds of books, Charles Petzold. But he has been a big support and just a lovely person. And he also knows how to handle commas a lot better than I do, and always finds all my typos and all of that. But, you know, he really, for instance, the scene in Chancellor Square Park where they're looking at the comet, his influence is in there, absolutely said, oh, read this book, you know, take a look at
right.
this. And that was extremely helpful.
Wow. That's the beauty of doing what you're doing, is just exploring a lot of different historical stories and people and events that have happened back during those times. It's such a magical journey for me to sit down and write historical fiction, which I did myself. Nothing like what you wrote, but I really had a lot of fun doing it. And it opened up my eyes and took me off into different directions, which I was really amazed at, and that's why I love that genre so much. But I would like to ask you now: is there anything in The Third Mrs. Galloway that you would change?
Not of the story itself. That there's. You do a lot of research, and if you continue researching on the same subject, you'll eventually find that you got a few little details incorrect. So that's not a big deal in terms of the whole scope of the book. I'm extremely proud of this book, and it's not that that surprises me. It's just that it is a thing that when I read it, it doesn't even feel like it was my creation. Because
right.
it just sounds like itself. One of the most interesting things that happened is, it's been made into an audiobook as well.
Yes.
That's, just available through Audible. And just hearing somebody else's interpretation of the book was really, really interesting and challenging, but I just was, you know, very, very happy to kind of hear it. It really made it a separate thing from me.
Right.
And, you know, when it comes to talking about the book, we're not talking about me, thankfully. We're talking about the book itself. I mean, I don't
right.
mind talking about my process, but the book is something separate, and I can put all my efforts into promoting it, whereas I cannot or have not ever done that for myself.
Yeah, I had Alexa read one of my books, and I was listening to it, and I listened, and I thought, by God, that writer's pretty good. And I was surprised that I was listening to my words, because I didn't really connect with it. I was into the story, and I really liked it, and it's really cool when that happens. So anyways, the reviews keep coming in, and I've looked at your reviews, and it's scoring a lot of 5 stars. How do you feel about reviews? How would you react with a 1 or 2 star review? I don't believe you've gotten any of those, but how would you react?
I want to go on a rampage, I think. I think when it gets a, you know, some kind of, when some part of it bothers somebody, I think it is more about them than it is about the book. Because it's, I would call this book totally vetted, you know, I mean, like it's been through not just me, not just the workshop, not just Kaylee, but also publishers of Akashic Books. And, you know, a lot of people have read and given input. So I know that it doesn't go off the rails. So then it's got to be, in a way, if somebody really was to trash it, that's definitely more about them than it is about me or the book.
Right.
Because
right.
I know that it's a piece of quality work that could easily rub people the wrong way if they have a certain outlook on life and on race, again, about racism and activism and that kind of thing. So I would say that if that doesn't mean everybody loves it with a 5-star review, but I think that it will be rubbing people the wrong way if it as you say goes up the bestseller list. There will certainly be people who look at it and say, this woman is dangerous.
right. Well, that's you know, you can put a feather in your cap on that one, because there are going to be people from the other side, if you want to call it that, that will see it in a different light than it was meant to be. But you know, that's just the way people are, I suppose. But as mentioned by me and others I have read, the characters are very rich in the way you develop them, and I really hate to see them go when I finally put the book down. Could you bring them back in a sequel? Will you please?
You know, I hate to let Maggie and Helen go, for sure. They are just so compelling. And I can't make any guarantees, but boy, is it tempting to dig in and see what happens to them after,
yeah.
you know, they sort of go in the directions that they go. Because especially for Helen, but Maggie too, her whole life has changed. And you know, what's that going to be like? So yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I agree about sometimes it is hard to just say, okay, I'm done with that character. I used to get depressed when I'd be reading books and it was like getting toward the end and I didn't want it to end.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, especially.
One thing I didn't mention, I just remembered, but when I sat down to read your book and they were moving into that shed during a thunderstorm, we actually had a thunderstorm here in Liverpool, New York, and there was a crackle of thunder overhead that nearly had me coming out of my seat. just as I was reading that part. And I thought that was a great beginning to reading your story, because it actually did put me right in the scene of that scene that you wrote. And I giggled about it, and I thought, gosh, there's something different about this, that it would happen while I'm reading the book. So I found it pretty amazing, and I really got a kick out of it.
Yeah, I can imagine just sitting there reading it and suddenly, bang,
some
lightning and thunder right over your head.
Where do you go to write? A special place in your house or somewhere else?
I have one of the things that my husband has been introducing me to over these years of our relationship is a lot of classical music. And, you know, you'll be reading the story of this composer, and they talk about this person goes up into the mountains and then they come back down with a symphony. So I have a very romantic idea about that. So I spend a lot of time in the Catskill Mountains and do a lot of writing here. But I also just hack it out in New York City, writing over, you know, in my apartment, wherever I actually can write in a lot of places. I don't need like absolute silence. Or for the last 3 years, I've been helping Charles take care of his mother before she passed away. So we were living with her, and I got a lot of writing done there too. So I wouldn't say that I was the most disciplined writer, but I do like to lose myself in it.
Yeah. It's nice to find that special place. Who are your favorite authors?
Yeah, I guess I should be ready for this kind of question. I mean, I really, like, for instance, with historical novels, when I was younger, I was probably reading things like, you know, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and those kind of novels that just took me out of where I was and put me into another place. And so I got absorbed by those, but I didn't understand quite what was going on. When I finally got what historical novels were, it was with Khalid Carr and his book, The Alienist, which was set right near where I lived in New York City. And so I could walk around and think, oh, this is where this scene is. Oh, this on 14th Street. This is where Delmonico's was. And, there was a reservoir here where the public library, you know, it just so amazed me, the transformation. So that was one of the things where I suddenly was very involved in just what historical novels were. And, you know, I have some guilty pleasures and that kind of thing. Like, I love Elizabeth Peters' books about Egyptology. And I like mysteries, like with Anne Perry and other people like that. But I can't, like, say, oh, this is the woman, the person who saved me. You know, this is the author who I've read so much of. I read a lot of Sue Kidd Monk. I've read Taylor Pilates. I've read a lot of Colson Whitehead. I don't know if there's, I think there might be one book I didn't read of his. But, you know, I actually read a lot more nonfiction than I read of fiction. So there we go.
You're talking about the historical fiction. Makes me want to take a drive down the thruway to Utica. I've been there several times. I'm an Uber driver, so makes me want to go down there and just kind of move around into the areas where you were mentioning in your book. I think I'm going to do that at some point here before winter sets in, but it's kind of fun to do, and now that I read the book, I really want to do that. We're getting down to the end here, Deidre, and it's been a pleasure having you on. I guess I would ask you for any parting words that you'd like to share, and where can people find you out there on the, as they used to say, the internets?
Well, I mean, I think I'll start just about where you start. I'll end just about where you started, which is that, yeah, just keep writing, because even if your writing is only for yourself, that you don't have to write like you're going to show it to anybody, it still is an excellent way into your own soul. And I think that that's important. I would say that one of the things that I learned sort of late in life was that I didn't have to have anybody's permission to be creative, and that I could just go ahead and be a writer. I could go ahead and make a film. I can go ahead and do that because that's what I want to do. And if I think I can get it together, then let it be judged on its own merit.
Right.
So that is it. You can find me at thirdmrsgalway.com.
Of course.
that's actually on my website, deirdresinnett.com, but it's a little easier to spell third Mrs. Galway, GALWAY.com, than deirdresinnett. What can I say?
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to meet you over the air here. I would like to meet up with you at one of your events, and I see that you have plenty of them. So really wish you much success in the future, and I'm going to look forward to that next Mrs. Galway novel. I'm sure it's in you somewhere, and I hope to hear from all your wonderful characters again someday. But for right now, thank you so much again for being on the Writer's Lounge. We really appreciate it, and we hope to hear from you soon again.
Tom, I really appreciate it, and it was a great conversation.
It sure was. Thank you so much, Deidre.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye. And there she goes, another author here on the show. Again, we've passed 96 now. That's 96 authors here on the Writer's Lounge. And this is where we talk about the final chapter and the final thoughts and intro to the next show. Monday, September 6, 2021, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to have on author Ollie Simmons. He wrote The Timepiece and The Girl Who Went Astray. William Wells, a moneyless American college dropout now living in London, was directed by his girlfriend Abigail to go to an old thrift store in Frying Pan Alley. When Will arrives, he is fascinated by all the old and interesting items within the shop. He is reminded of his and Abigail's upcoming first anniversary and her love of old clocks and watches, and soon he is shown an unusual and interesting but inexpensive timepiece produced by the proprietor of the shop. He decides to buy it, but then something horrific happens. The shop owner is shot to death after two men entered just as Will was leaving. Will is now a witness to a murder, and then he becomes a suspect. And if that is not enough, Abby vanishes after holding the gifted watch that William gave her. I hope you will join us 2 weeks from today when we will sit down with Ollie Simmons. Until then, see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers alike to keep that pen and those eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. to make